The NBA, marketing the minstrel show, and serving the big gangsters. The minstrel show in the history of America featured performers dressed up and made up and acting in a way that presented a buffoonish caricature of African-American physical and cultural features. And while often the performers were actually whites in blackface, sometimes minstrel shows involved the further absurdity of blacks with blackface makeup to exaggerate certain features, coerced and or induced to play these cartoonish and insulting characters. In the book On the Real Side, Laughing, Lying, and Signifying, the underground tradition of African-American humor that transformed American culture from slavery to Richard Pryor, the author, Mel Watkins, in the chapter on minstrelsy, makes the point that going back to slavery days, quote, by focusing on and exaggerating the supposedly earthy peculiarities of blacks, blackface mimics provided the simple, folksy entertainment white audiences demanded and assured them that indeed they were superior to their enslaved brethren, unquote. He points out that it was in the minstrel show that the character of Jim Crow was popularized as, quote, an unkempt, ignorant plantation slave, unquote. And we know what Jim Crow came to symbolize after the Civil War, the whole system of segregation and KKK terror and all the rest, lynching with it and everything else. Watkins adds that in minstrelsy there was a, quote, double-edged burlesque in which not only were serious issues lampooned, but blacks' ability to understand or interpret sophisticated ideas were ridiculed and mocked, unquote. And Watkins presents the following analysis, which unfortunately has an eerily all too similar echo, an all too familiar echo today, in terms of how the thinking of many white people, particularly among the more comfortable and privileged, is both catered to and at the same time conditioned. He writes, quote, the idyllic portrait of plantation life served Southern pro-slavery interests as well as the interests of Northerners who comprised the largest audience for minstrel shows and were none too anxious to have hordes of free blacks migrating to their urban communities. Even those whites who may have been ideologically opposed to slavery but uninformed about the actual conditions of slaves were influenced, since the myth of the happy-go-lucky Negro justified adopting a hands-off attitude toward a practice they may have morally condemned, unquote. Further, Watkins makes this incisive observation, quote, Americans who detested flesh and blood blacks relished the minstrelsy-inspired caricatures that flooded the country. Minstrelsy made Sambo as American as apple pie. Minstrelsy made Sambo as American as apple pie. Few Americans, black or white, escaped its degrading influence, unquote. And finally, it is worth reflecting on the following from Watkins. Quote, the imbecilic stage black man created by white minstrels functioned to cast black laughter and blacks' uninhibited behavior in all forms permanently in a recognizable, absurd, and non-threatening form. Recognizable, absurd, and non-threatening. The minstrel black man served as a kind of alter ego, providing whites, that is specifically here the white performers in blackface, with the vicarious experience of breaking free from the rigid restraints of civilized European behavior and expressing their natural, or as they interpreted it, vulgar instincts. Moreover, they did so while allowing white audiences the luxury of remaining aloof, from the ludicrous dark characters presented in the minstrel shows. And here I've added emphasis on certain words for reasons that will become more apparent as we go along. In other words, the minstrel shows provided whites, including many overtly racist whites, with the opportunity to be entertained by degrading caricatures of black people in a way that was not challenging or threatening, and which in fact reinforced those whites' smug sense of superiority. What I have cited and spoken to here about minstrel shows, and particularly as concentrated in the last statement quoted from Watkins, the point about being non-threatening and the luxury of remaining aloof, this is in fact a commentary that is both directly relevant to today's NBA and provides a foundation for analyzing more extensively the nature and role of the NBA and the ways in which it reflects and in certain ways serves to reinforce dominant oppressive relations in U.S. society as well as in an important dimension internationally. Basketball, as we know in the U.S. today, has been come to be identified as a quote-unquote black sport. And it is the sport that's most popular in the inner city and among black youth in particular and black people more broadly. Of course, it's not always has not always been true in the history of this country that basketball, or more specifically professional basketball, and the NBA in particular, was a black sport. For a long time, blacks were excluded from the professional leagues, and in particular the NBA, as they were from other sports, the other mainstream sports. In fact, the Harlem Globetrotters developed specifically because of that exclusion and in opposition to it, and there was a time when finally the NBA teams made a mistake of agreeing to play exhibition series with the Harlem Globetrotters, who then played very seriously indeed and actually defeated the NBA All-Stars that they played. So that's sort of a backdrop to fill in further the foundation for analyzing the role of the NBA today. In these days, there is, including in the mainstream media, a lot of self-righteous hand-wringing and denunciation concerning what is supposedly wrong with sports. For example, there's been a lot in the news lately about Barry Bonds, who just surpassed Babe Ruth for a number of home runs in a career. And he's closing in on Hank Aaron, who holds the record for a number of home runs in baseball. And it's interesting that when Hank Aaron finally broke the long-held, decades-held-long record of Babe Ruth for total number of home runs, he got many death threats and other racist attacks simply because he was going to break the record of a hallowed white man. And this was in, you know, recent modern times, post-civil rights America, quote-unquote. And now Barry Bonds, a whole big deal is made about how he's taken steroids and he's cheating. And this is not only the height of hypocrisy in general, but it has a very specific hypocrisy, because a few years ago, some of you may remember, there was a strike in baseball. And all the fans who want their entertainment, after all, this is America, were furious, of course, with the players, not with the owners. They were furious with the players and, fuck them, I don't need that baseball. And the attendance and the viewership on television fell off significantly when the strike was over and the season resumed. And one of the most exciting things in baseball is the home run. You hit the ball out of the field, over the fence. You know, there are little ditties and songs written about it and so on. But it is one of the, you know, let's face it, to a large degree, baseball is a snooze, okay? They, you know, spend a lot more time, even more than in football, doing nothing. You know, or scratching their ass or whatever it is, they do. And there's very little actual action. So a home run is kind of a punctuation that is set off from a lot of the dullness and boredom. And the simple fact is that after this strike, one of the ways in which, and this was encouraged definitely by the ownership and the executives of the league, one of the ways they recouped interest was to have a home run contest between Mark Aguirre and Sammy Sosa. Were they going to break the home run record for a single season? Which one of them was going to hit more home runs? And all the drama came back. And of course, Mark Aguirre admitted, and he's been a little bit defiant about it, that he was taking supplements to strengthen his body, and it's come out about Sammy Sosa, various things that he was doing. But the people who were running the baseball leagues were very happy to have this happen because it was bringing the fans back. They were undoubtedly encouraging it and certainly were doing nothing to discourage, let alone stop it. But now all of a sudden, Bush makes a speech in the State of the Union, in which he talks about the problem of steroids in sports. It's all part of this whole repressive atmosphere, you know, and poking into every corner of everybody's lives and accusing people of being traitors. Even the New York Times now has been attacked by Bush and Cheney. And Peter King, a congressman in New York, who's actually one of the few who voted against the Clinton impeachment, has been brought in line, is now talking about investigating the New York Times for violations of the Espionage Act, for revealing that the government was spying on the financial records of lots of American citizens. So this is all part of a repressive atmosphere, and in this context, a book comes out talking about how Barry Bonds has been doping and taking steroids and on and on. And one of the things that was pointed out a little while ago in our newspaper about this whole baseball steroid scandal, even before the Barry Bonds thing became such a big deal, was people are talking about how if Barry Bonds breaks the home run record, it should have an asterisk on it. See, when Roger Maris broke the single-season home run record, hit 61 home runs in a season, that's the title of the movie by Billy Crystal. 61. It's about Roger Maris hitting 61. And Billy Crystal's a New York Yankee fan. I've always thought Billy Crystal has been an old man trapped in a young man's body. And finally, his body's catching up with him. But in any case, one of the manifestations of that, he's a big New York Yankee fan. I mean, he's talented, and some of the things he does are funny, and maybe even positive in some ways. But there it is nonetheless. So because when Roger Maris broke the home run record, it was a longer season. There were 162 games, if I remember correctly, instead of 154, so they put an asterisk by it because Babe Ruth hit his home run record in 154 games, so they put a little asterisk by Roger Maris' record of 61. Now they're saying if Barry Bonds breaks the all-time record of Hank Aaron, see, now all of a sudden Hank Aaron, he's fine. A few years ago, he was a nigger and everything else and deserved to be killed for breaking Babe Ruth's record, but now Barry Bonds is threatening to establish himself, so now Bonds becomes the focus of all this hatred. Not that I'm a big Barry Bonds fan. He's not even very, you know, enlightened or progressive in a lot of different ways, but that's not the issue here. They're saying there should be an asterisk beside the record even when he sets it, which he probably will. If not this season, then probably next. And it was pointed out in our newspaper, well, if you're going to talk about asterisks, every record in baseball should have an asterisk that was set before black people were allowed in the league. Because you had a whole separate so-called Negro leagues in which there were great players, including great home run hitters like Josh Gibson, who were not allowed into the league. So they weren't in the competition to set these records. So all of our newspaper very correctly and importantly pointed out all these records should have asterisks if you're going to do it that way. And then, you know, there's all this talk about, you know, coming off Bush's whole thing about steroids and Barry Bonds' character is flawed and marred. And never mind what criticism we might have of Barry Bonds. But, you know, look what they're holding him up against. Babe Ruth, you know, who was a drunkard, abusive, you know, a quote-unquote womanizer. All this was well known, but it was not, you know, built up in the media. Babe Ruth was made into a demigod by the sports writers and the media in general. Or Ty Cobb, one of the great all-time baseball players, was a supporter and probably an active member of the Ku Klux Klan and an open white supremacist during the time he was playing baseball. But there aren't any asterisks besides whatever accomplishments he had in baseball. See the bottom of the page for a discussion of his racism. So these are the kind of values that get portrayed in all this discussion about what's wrong with sports in America these days. And the general tenor and feel of the discussion, an ethos, if you will, of a discussion of what's wrong with sports, is never very far separated from the fact that not so much in baseball these days, but in football to a large degree, and basketball overwhelmingly, these are quote-unquote sports dominated by black people. And the general sense that's put out that there's something not right about sports, and they just aren't like what they used to be. We just don't have the same heroes. These players today are just selfish, and all they care about is money. I mean, it is a capitalist enterprise, after all. Not that the players are the capitalists, but I mean, it is a money-making enterprise, and yet the players are criticized because they care about money, because they've learned that that's what the deal is. And that's what the owners are basing everything on, is money and profit. So somehow there's something wrong with sports, as if the Babe Ruth played for free. Or as if none of the players today have a love for the game simply because they make money. And this is never, as I said, very far separated from the fact that these sports are not white in the way they used to be. And in particular, there's an incessant criticism of the NBA, and once again, particularly its players, which is hardly unrelated to the reality that the NBA is overwhelmingly made up of African-American athletes. And in fact, most of the non-African-American white European athletes are from Europe and not from the United States anymore. This is not for genetic reasons, but for economic and social reasons. There are plenty of white people with talent enough to play basketball, but they have other avenues for doing things, and some of them don't choose to go into a sport that's culturally alien to them, even though it shouldn't be. Not all, but some. But what is very striking with all this is that perhaps not surprisingly, but still strikingly, there is, especially in the mainstream media, no real discussion of what is really and essentially wrong with the NBA in particular. Now, to get into this a little bit, we can cite a recent outburst that occurred during the course of the just concluded NBA championship this year. Dallas, representing the Western Conference, played Miami, representing the Eastern Conference, and Dallas won the first two games, and then Miami won the next four. And Shaquille O'Neal and Pat Riley got another championship. And during what would turn to be a very pivotal game, the fifth game of the series, it's a best of seven. Whoever wins four games first wins. And it was two games each, and then in the fifth game, it went right down to the wire, and the star player for Miami, Dwayne Wade, went driving to the basket without going into too much details, and a foul was called, and it was a highly questionable foul, and then there was another questionable call relating to a technicality about a timeout. And there was a lot of murmur about this, and right at the end of this game, Mark Cuban, who's one of these computer whiz guys who's gotten billions of dollars and bought the Dallas Mavericks, and he's always hanging out around the court and making a spectacle of himself and, you know, mouthing off about things. And he periodically gets fined by the NBA for speaking out of school. Partly they like to build him up, and it helps build up the league, and partly he does once in a while say things he shouldn't. But he's got enough money. He just writes a check for $200,000 or whatever, and it's over with. This time, however, there was a big controversy because he rushed onto the floor after the fifth game and began shouting, and it was reported that he began swearing at David Stern, the mafia-like commissioner of the NBA. And more specifically, he was reported to have said, "Bleep you and your bleeping league is rigged." Bleep meaning fuck. I'm just reporting what they said in the newspaper and then interpreting it. And then, shortly after that, Mark Cuban was constrained to issue a statement saying, no, I never said those things, and I never confronted David Stern, didn't happen, never said it, so on and so forth. Well, whether he actually said it or not, and he probably did, but we don't know for sure, at least I don't know for sure, but whether he said it or not, it did actually speak to something very real. That bleeping league is bleeping rigged. And I want to talk about how and what importance it has and what significance it has. Because things in the cultural arena are very significant and do react back upon everything else, as we've discussed a lot. So the real insult here, you know, Cuban said, well, you know, if I said the league was rigged, that would be an insult to the players and how hard they play. But the real insult here, in a sense to the players, but more generally and more importantly to people who follow basketball and especially those who love it and who look to the NBA as the pinnacle of the sport, the real insult is once again that the NBA is indeed rigged. And this is all part of how the NBA product, and along with that certain values and a certain outlook, are marketed and promoted in the U.S. and increasingly on an international scale. So first I want to talk about the NBA's marketing strategy. Its marketing strategy, including a whole racist component to this marketing strategy, especially since the early 1980s. Now, in his book, autobiographical book, Giant Steps, which unfortunately seems to be largely out of print now, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was a great basketball player, sort of shunted to the side, not given his due because he's a little bit out of step culturally and socially. He's a Muslim, and he also has had some progressive things to say in the past. And actually, he was the one really prominent athlete who did boycott the 1968 Olympics. And he pointed out in his book, Giant Steps, that at a certain point around the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s, there was a whole shift. This is actually started before David Stern became the commissioner of the NBA and then took off to a whole other level once he became commissioner. There was a shift in how they marketed the NBA, and this was concentrated to a significant degree, although not entirely, in the building of whole new stadiums and the financing of these stadiums often at public expense, but the building of stadiums not in the inner cities where they'd been, but in these suburban areas. So you have, for example, the Detroit Pistons. You know, Detroit. As soon as you say Detroit in America, everybody thinks black. But the Detroit Pistons play in the quote-unquote palace in Auburn Hills, which is a wealthy suburb far and safely away from Detroit. And that's where the Detroit Pistons play. Now, there are some arenas that either have come back into the inner cities, but then they're built in a certain way as part of this overall pattern. But many of them have remained in the suburban areas. You have this kind of irony in Detroit, by the way, that while the Detroit Pistons play this quote-unquote black sport in the suburb, the wealthy suburb of Auburn Hills, the Detroit Red Wings, the hockey team, play in the inner city arena, the Joe Louis Arena. I mean, this is some weird shit, you know? And it's all, you know, let's face it, you know, When the players are playing hockey, now I don't want to lapse into nationalism here, okay? But when the players are playing hockey, we can say at least metaphorically, it is hard to follow the game because they're so much alike to the color of the ice, okay? But they're playing in Joe Louis Arena, this all-white sport followed by all-white fans almost entirely. There are a few black players and a few black fans. But this is an overwhelmingly white sport played in Joe Louis Arena in Detroit. Meanwhile, the NBA has marketed itself by moving its arenas overwhelmingly to the suburbs and or marketing, pricing things so that only wealthy, not ordinary, not working class, not even lower petty bourgeois, but wealthy, either corporations or corporate executives or stockbrokers and so on, can afford any decent seats. I mean, sometimes ordinary people get in and they sit up somewhere that isn't really in the arena, even though technically it is. I mean, You know, you need binoculars to see, you know, what the players look like and even what their numbers are if you are in the cheap seats. But this is all marketed to a wealthy, overwhelmingly, not entirely, you know, there are middle-class blacks and so on, but overwhelmingly white target audience. And so is the television. If you watch the ads, it's marketed to this demographic of wealthier whites. So you watch the ads, and that, you know, they're not the things that the youth in the inner city, by and large. There are some ads directed to them. But that's not, by and large, what the marketing is directed toward. But it's not simply, this is only one manifestation, it's not simply that it's marketed to these strata. So you have this acute contradiction, which I'll talk about later, which the players are also aware of and made aware of, if they don't become aware of it, that you have this quote-unquote black league playing for a wealthy white audience. It's a very acute contradiction. Now, I'm not saying white people shouldn't be allowed to watch basketball. I wouldn't like that rule at all. But the point is, what are they doing here with this marketing strategy? Think back to the minstrel show as we go along. What are they doing here? And the other thing they've done, it's bad enough that they market it this way financially, so to speak, but along with that, as an integral part of that, they develop these whole stereotypes. And I'll talk about this in a little while. For example, the Boston Celtics. Boston, you know, the home of Southie, the working class Irish whites, you know, and with the whole history of, you know, the busing and segregation and overt racism there. The Boston Celtics were built up as the white lunch bucket blue collar work ethic team, with Larry Bird as their star. Now, I actually happen to think, objectively, Larry Bird was a great basketball player, but that's almost beside the point. We should be scientific and objective about everything. But it's almost beside the point. This was built up, and at one time, the Boston Celtics, during the year that they actually won a championship, or was played for it and won it, if I remember correctly, actually, I think, were the only team in the NBA other than the Utah Jazz in Mormon land. And let's remember, the Mormons until 1978 had as part of their official doctrine that black people were inferior. And they only changed that out of political expediency. And the fundamental, that's one of the complaints of the fundamentalist Mormons, among other things, besides polygamy. That's one of their big complaints, that they changed that. And they still hold to that belief. So other than Utah Jazz, the Celtics were the only team that actually fielded five players on the court at the same time who were all white. And I don't want to get into conspiracy theories, but including the Mormon Danny Ainge, by the way. But you don't have to get into conspiracy. Well, first of all, let me say about conspiracy theories, as I once said in an argument with somebody, conspiracy theories are only wrong if there are no conspiracies. The question is, are people conspiring to do something? And yes, they are here. So they had the Boston Celtics built up that way, and then they had the Los Angeles Lakers for a while with Magic Johnson, increasingly as a symbol of this, who were a sanitized, watered-down, sanitized version of playground basketball. And the 1980s, when this marketing strategy took hold in the NBA, and I'll come back to this more, was characterized by the contest and the contrast, usually meeting in the NBA Finals, playing for the championship, or in any case held up as the two poles of the working class, white, blue-collar, work ethic, hard-working, disciplined team, and the Los Angeles Lakers as the watered-down version of playground, out of control, but under control, basketball. And this is the way the NBA marketed itself to this audience, which had now become its target audience in terms of the stadiums, in terms of television revenues, all kinds of stuff like that. So you had this rather glaring contradiction between where the NBA players increasingly have come from, particularly those drawn from the U.S., and I'll talk a little bit more about the international dimension later. That is overwhelmingly from the ghettos and the inner cities. And on the other hand, where the main audience comes from, at least in terms of who actually attends NBA games. And as I said, what the main target demographic is, grouped by income, race, residency, etc., in terms of the NBA's overall marketing strategy. Now, if you understand that this is a capitalist enterprise and that it involves billions of dollars and that it's driven, as they say in the language, in their language, that it's driven by market considerations, it's market-driven. The most important thing is marketing and making the money. Then it becomes, you know, if you step back from it, you could ask yourself a simple question. Are they really going to allow what the basketball players and the coaches are capable of doing in competition with each other to determine what the outcome of not just particular games, but the whole season and the championship and how they market the championship? Are they really going to allow that just to be determined, quote unquote, on the floor? Obviously, they don't. Or maybe it isn't obvious, but I'll bring out some facts that show how real that is. So a big part of their marketing strategy, which goes along with the other components I've been mentioning, is what I call fakeness. Or what Mark Cuban blurted out by saying, or apparently blurted out by saying, rigged. And the fakeness and the racism have gone hand in hand together. I remember the Lakers, I mentioned the Lakers and the Celtics. This was what characterized the remarketing of the NBA in the 1980s. Let me give you a few more illustrations. One year during the 1980s, when once again, someone actually wrote a letter in a newspaper one time, I think it was the USA Today, and said, "What's the big deal about the NBA Finals? It's always the Lakers and the Celtics. Whose turn is it to win this year anyway?" This was someone who was get a basic sense of how this was working. So it was the Lakers and the Celtics. The Lakers, every once in a while, the Philadelphia 76ers got in there, and one year or two, the Houston Rockets got in there, but they were playing the Celtics. And one year during the Lakers and Celtics championship series, ho-hum, the Lakers came out for the first game in Boston, and instead of doing the high-five when the players were introduced, you know, they'd high-five each other, which there's a lot of dispute, just to back up for a second, about where the high-five came from. My favorite story is it was introduced to sports by Glenn Burke, who went to Berkeley High, and then ended up playing professional baseball. Unfortunately, which I didn't know at the time he went to Berkeley High, he was gay, and he ended up dying of AIDS. And he didn't even come out openly as gay during the time he was playing baseball. But Dusty Baker, who was his baseball manager, says Glenn Burke's the one that popularized the high five in sports. Anyway, if we wanted to be subjective, I could say I choose to believe that. But since we're being scientific, I won't insist that that's the fact. But anyway, it became popularized, and then it gets into the culture. There's a lot of things, and this is one of the points of Mel Watkins' book, a lot of things coming out of black people's culture gets popularized and, you know, taken up broadly. So you even see stockbrokers high-fiving each other these days, you know, which renders it a certain bit meaningless. But this year, the Lakers came out, instead of doing the high-five, they did a low-five. And, you know, when the players were introduced, they would slap hands down here instead of up here. Oh, what are they doing now? You know, like Richard Pryor said, it might be a kind of a conspiracy. What are they up to? So, the next game, they didn't do it. They were back to the high five. And then there was actually an article in the USA Today commenting about how the Lakers were told not to do this. That they were to discontinue doing this. Ooh, it's too threatening. And here's a very telling statement. Michael Cooper, who was player for the Lakers, not one of their prominent players, but a prominent reserve off the bench, as they say, actually said the following, very cleverly worded. He said, "We were told not to do this by someone higher than the team and lower than God." So you can draw your own conclusions. Now, during the same period, Kevin McHale, who was part of these Boston teams during these years, was interviewed, and CBS was then covering the NBA Finals. And he was interviewed. Now, keep in mind, this was a taped interview, so it could have been edited. Obviously, they go over these things before they air. It wasn't a live interview. It was a taped interview during these years. And he was asked about playing for the Celtics. Now, Kevin McHale's from Minnesota. I believe that he's one of two prominent people in the world from Hibbing, Minnesota, the other one being Bob Dylan. If I'm not mistaken, he's also from Hibbing, Kevin McHale. But he's from Minnesota in any case. And he was being interviewed about playing for the Celtics. And this is what he said. If you are an Irish boy from Minnesota, pause, a white Irish boy from Minnesota playing for the Celtics is a dream. Now, there's this redundancy here has a purpose. There, what other kind of Irish are there besides white Irish in America? So it was like, duh, in case you didn't get it, hey, Irish, oh, maybe there's some dullards out there, white Irish. Now, this was not considered offensive. As I said, you know, I'm sure David Stern's office reviewed this tape. They don't leave things to accident, and it was fine with them to build these things up this way. If you are an Irish boy from Minnesota, a white Irish boy, playing for the Celtics is a dream. So on the one hand, a force higher than the team and lower than God told the Lakers, okay, that's not in the script, cut that out. And then they put this interview with Kevin McHale on the TV, a taped interview. During the same period as this strategy was taking hold in the 80s, Julius Erving, known by the nickname of Doc or the Doctor, was sort of the symbol of the black style of basketball, although as he himself admitted, one time he jokingly said he was asked how many white guys they had on the Philadelphia 76ers when he played for them, and he said, well, there's so-and-so and so-and-so, and me, of course. Jokingly commentating somewhat self-deprecatingly on the fact that his whole style had been toned down or even made to be more respectable. But nonetheless, he was a symbol of, you know, having come off the playground. He got his nickname because people said, let's go to the playground and watch the doctor operate on the court. And as this Lakers-Celtics thing was taking more and more hold and this was being implemented as the marketing strategy, Julius Erving, who finally won a championship, they brought in Moses Malone, another black player from Houston, so they could get a championship for Julius Erving. See, this, all this stuff is marketing, because it's not just the game. There's jerseys and all this other paraphernalia. And often they have, by the way, just to digress for a second, to flesh out the picture, often they have the same team repeat, because it takes more than 1 year to successfully and sufficiently market all the all the accoutrement, all the jerseys and all the hats and everything else from these teams. So a two-year thing is a better marketing strategy. Not always, but often. So Erving had gotten his championship, and then he was sort of being eased out of prominence. And there was a very telling incident that happened. In a game between the Boston Celtics and the 76ers, Larry Bird and Julius Erving got into a fight. And it was very interesting. I got all the shit on tape, so you can review it and watch it. Very interesting to watch the progression in the media of how they treated and reported on this fight. When you watched it, this is also, you watch CNN a lot of times. You watch CNN before they've had time to edit it. A lot of times you see things that they then edit out later on. So if you hear something big happen, you rush and put on CNN, not Fox, but you put on CNN because there's a lot of unedited shit that gets through before they filter it out. And this was similar to what happened, you know, you watched on ESPN, and they just sort of showed the raw footage. Larry Bird clearly provoked and started the fight. And Julius Erving sort of reluctantly fought back. And then the fight was broken up. But then on ESPN, during the very same day as the broadcast went on, they edited out the first part in terms of the pictures, and put over the narrative that increasingly blamed Julius Erving for the fight. Even though if you watched ESPN itself at the beginning, you roll the tape back, you could see that their own account of it showed that Bird had started the fight. But what was even more damning and revealing was that wasn't enough for them to shift the blame for this fight. But then they had commentary over it about how, well, I guess Irving is just getting frustrated because he's past his prime and he's being surpassed by Bird, and that's why he started this fight. So right in front of your eyes, not only was, you know, does this sound like any other sphere you're familiar with? Facts were being altered in front of you, and then they were being reinterpreted according to a certain narrative. And then in the same period, there was the infamous Isaiah Thomas incident. And I'll talk a lot about this because this is really concentrates a lot of things. Isaiah Thomas came out of the inner city of Chicago. And, you know, I got my own beef with Isaiah Thomas because at the time he came out, there was DePaul was... You know, I was living in Maywood at the time, in DePaul, which is a suburb of Chicago, for those of you who don't know, and, you know, it was a proletarian suburb and had a really good high school basketball team, but we can't go too far afield here. And Mark Aguirre went to high school in Chicago, and he was playing, and then he'd gone on and played for DePaul in Chicago, and they were in a position to try to win the, you know, they had a good team, they might have had a chance to win the college championship, the NCAA men's championship. And Isaiah Thomas was coming out of, he'd gone, if you ever saw that movie Hoop Dreams, he went from the inner city to a suburban Catholic school. And then there's a question, where was he going to go to college? And Mark Aguirre was a close friend of Isaiah Thomas, boyhood friend, as they say. And there was a lot of talk about how he was going to therefore go to DePaul, and if he'd gone to DePaul, that would have really put them over the top, probably. But instead, Isaiah Thomas made, if you'll pardon the expression, a devil's bargain. Which also tells you about how this shit goes on even on the college level. He ended up going to the University of Indiana and playing for the infamous Robert Montgomery Knight, otherwise known as Bobby or Bob Knight, the brute, you know, who not only yells at but chokes and punches his own players and has made a principle out of saying, as a matter of principle, the players don't know anything about the game. We'll talk about later about coaching and the players and the dialectics of that. But Isaiah Thomas, and it was during this time that Bobby Knight went to Puerto Rico as part of a U.S. team and came out with all sorts of racist, insulting comments about Puerto Ricans, and he actually got arrested and put in jail. And it was a whole scandal. And in this context, Isaiah Thomas, instead of going to DePaul, went to Indiana. And they made this kind of devil's bargain. Bobby Knight coaches basketball in a very regimented way. You know, he's known, you can hear Dick Vitale, the famous basketball commentator, you know, loudmouth, you know, who's made a career out of sounding like, you know, sort of like, you know, self-mocking idiot. Oh, you want to hear my prediction on this? Anyway. So, you know, Dick Vitale is always talking about how Bobby Knight should be in the Hall of Fame, even after they finally kicked him out of Indiana. Not because he was brutalizing the players, so that was the reason they gave, but his coaching success was falling off. So Isaiah Thomas went to Indiana to play for the Bobby Knight, whom Dick Vitale calls the general. He's the general. This is the way he approaches coaching. It was sort of a military martinet dictator brute. And what was the bargain here? Well, Bobby Knight needed a really great player to come in and get him another championship. And it was important not just for Bobby Knight, but for basketball in general. Because even college basketball, they're not just promoting basketball, they're promoting ideology. And what was represented by Bobby Knight at that time was an embodiment of the values they wanted to promote. They're very aware that although they market the game to this other audience and demographic that I'm talking about, that the people who really follow it and are influenced in a big way by it are even more the inner city youth. So both for them and for other strata, they want to promote certain values. At that time, it was Bobby Knight. Then after his success went down and he got caught on tape choking one of his players and everything, then it became Mike Krzyzewski at Duke. And it's so blatant at Duke nowadays that you hear these people like Dick Vitale and these other commentators having to respond to the widely known fact that Duke gets all kinds of breaks from the officials and to help them win games, because Duke is now held up as the big model. And then, of course, we got the lacrosse Duke's team rape scandal, which is, you know, spilling out and causing problems there, too. It'll be interesting to see how that gets all resolved. It's not entirely under their control, but it'd be interesting to see what different forces do in real life. I'm sure there's a lot of behind-the-scenes shit going on with that one, you know, because that will spill over and you know, cast a shadow over and sour the reputation of Mike Krzyzewski if it comes out a certain way, the coach of Duke, which has now replaced Indiana and Bobby Knight as the model. You know, and you hear Dick Vitale on there talking, "Oh, all these people say Duke gets breaks. Come on, baby. That's not the way it is. Come on, they're just good." So Isaiah Thomas, back in the days when it was Bobby Knight in Indiana, was the embodiment of the way basketball ought to be played, or one model for a certain type of way of playing basketball. Isaiah Thomas went there, and what did Bobby Knight do? He let Isaiah Thomas play a lot more in Isaiah Thomas's own style of playing. He loosened the reins on him a lot. And that was the bargain they made. I don't know what the exact terms were, but it's clear what the bargain was. And within 2 years, they won a championship, and then Isaiah Thomas got out of there and went into the NBA. He got what he was looking for out of it, and Bobby Knight and Indiana and whatever that represents and whomever that represents got what they wanted out of it. But then Isaiah Thomas, it's interesting about basketball, by the way. I could, as you might imagine, talk about it a long time. But when I was in Chicago, they had the first year I got there, they had the Chicago City Championship in basketball. High school basketball championship. And I thought, wow, that's going to be great. And here's Mark Aguirre, and there was another guy. He was a junior. There was another guy named Eddie Johnson, who also played in the NBA, who was a senior. They were on this team from Westinghouse. And then there was other team, that was on the west side of Chicago, and there was another team on the south side called Phillips. They were playing for the city championship. Oh, this would be a great game. So I call up and inquire how to get tickets. Well, are you a student? No, I don't think so. Well, are you affiliated with one of the schools? No. Well, I'm sorry, the game is only open to people who are students, relatives, or people affiliated with the school. In other words, the general public, i.e. the masses of people, who, like me, would have loved to go to this game, were excluded. They are too dangerous to be allowed into the game. An interesting footnote to that, by the way, is that the Westinghouse team, despite the fact it had these two NBA players, or future NBA players, lost the city championship to Phillips. A lot of people who are very good on the high school level never make it past that, for a lot of reasons, some of which we're very familiar with. But my frustrations about that aside, Isaiah Thomas went into the NBA and had his own frustrations. He couldn't get over the hump. He was playing for the Detroit Pistons. He became an all-star, prominent player. But every year, Detroit was in the Eastern Conference with the Boston Celtics during the 1980s. And every year, they'd play the Celtics. And every year, they'd lose. And Isaiah Thomas was getting more and more frustrated. And finally, in 1987, they playing a series again at seven games. And it was two games apiece, and the fifth game was being played at Boston. And Detroit was ahead, I believe, by a point with just a few seconds to go in the game, right on the verge of winning, and then the next game would be played in Detroit. So it would be harder for the NBA to make them lose in Detroit than it would be in Boston. And right at the end of the game, there's this play, they replay it all the time if you watch any basketball highlights, where Isaiah Thomas, you know, Boston scores a basket, they're behind by a point, and so Detroit has to throw the ball inbounds so they can go down toward their own basket. And Isaiah Thomas grabs the ball and throws it backward, and Larry Bird comes in and steals the ball and puts it in, and then Boston wins the game. And over again, you see this played in basketball highlights, years and even now a couple of decades later. And it's all, you know, then on top of it, there's, the, you know, not only the injury, but the insult. I mean, it's like Isaiah Thomas had, it was right there in his hands, and he fucked up. And he fucked up by letting Larry Bird, the symbol of the Celtics, grab the ball, you know, and steal his bad pass and put it in. Well, at this time, Dennis Rodman, who's already becoming something of a wild card in the NBA and has had numerous post-NBA careers of dubious distinction, but he was frustrated. I mean, he did later on, when he was playing for Chicago, he did have the, I will call it a virtue, of saying during one of the games he was asked about playing the Utah Jazz, when they were playing the Utah Jazz for championship, this was in the 90s. He said, well, what's it like playing in Utah? And he said, well, it's hard to concentrate with all these fucking Mormons around. And then he had to apologize, but I didn't think any apology was required. In any case, back when the Pistons and the Celtics in this pivotal Game 5, but the Celtics won because of Isaiah Thomas's mistake, and I'll talk more about what really went on there in a second, or the more important thing that went on. They went around, they're interviewing players after the game. They go into the loser's locker room, and they come to Dennis Rodman, who is something of a little bit of a wild card even then. See, he figured out this is all about marketing, so why shouldn't I just market myself while we're at it? You know, why? They got their marketing strategy, and I got mine. So they put the microphone in his face and said, well, what do you think about that Larry Bird? Isn't he a great player? And he said, nah, I don't really think he's that great. He just, you know, if he weren't white, he'd just be another really good player. Oh, woo! You know, you would have thought that, you know, like a state secret had been given away. And in a sense, it had. Now, again, Larry Bird is a very good player, or was a very good player. Objectively, that's true. But that wasn't the essence of what was going on here. So what did they do right away? You know, they said, well, who do you think is a good player? And he said, Magic Johnson, Rodman. Now, I have my own theory about Magic. I don't think Magic Johnson, ironically, is that great of a player, or was that great of a player. But he was a great showman, and he fit into the NBA's marketing very well. That's another thing. But I won't get into that now. That's a whole other controversy that I won't dig into right here. But that's what Dennis Rodman said. Who do you think is a great player then? Magic Johnson. So what did they do? Here's a very telling thing about all of American society, not just about basketball. Immediately, the media did what? They went to the responsible Negro spokesman, Isaiah Thomas, to put this comment by Dennis Rodman in its place and everything that's involved in that. Isaiah, what do you think about Dennis Rodman's comment? Well, just remember now, this is just a few minutes after this game where Isaiah Thomas has been so frustrated these years, can't get past the Celtics. He's made what he probably knows is a bad play, and it's being rubbed in his face already. It's already being replayed, even as they're interviewing him. And he loses it for a moment. He says, well, I agree with Dennis. If he weren't white, he'd be just another really good player. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, not funny. This became the biggest diplomatic incident in the recent history of sports. I mean, this became a gigantic scandal. And there was buzz going on all over the place, and Magic Johnson was more or less openly negotiating with the heads of the NBA not to have Isaiah Thomas drummed out of the league, essentially. I mean, Isaiah Thomas said later, I realized my whole career was flashing before my eyes after I said this. My whole career was on the line. And I'm sure you could see it because you could see what was happening out in the open, that behind the scenes, Magic Johnson, who was a very prominent part of the whole NBA game and a very good friend of Isaiah Thomas, I'm sure went and negotiated with David Stern and said, look, you can't just drive him out of the league. And what happened? What was the result of all this jockeying and open discussion about, was this going to tear the whole NBA apart? Because this struck at the whole marketing strategy of the NBA, the fakeness and the racism. Larry Bird, again, I do think he was a very good player, but Larry Bird was held up as the great white hype. And here was not only Dennis Rodman, but the responsible Negro, Isaiah Thomas, a key part of this marketing strategy, even though he hadn't yet been allowed to win his championship, tearing this down and introducing not only unspoken but unspeakable element here. You can say it's great to be white and play for the Celtics, but you cannot say that in this mainly black league, we have to have some white stars so white fans can identify with them, regardless of whether they're really good or not. I mean, they have to be somewhat good. You can't build up somebody who can't even play. And there was literally an official enactment of a drama, a public press conference played not only in ESPN, but on a regular news media, of Isaiah Thomas publicly apologizing, virtually, if not literally, on his knees, to Larry Bird, and Larry Bird, and with the greatest of paternalism, graciously accepting his apology. Now, you're talking about grown men here who voiced their opinion, right or wrong, about something, and it had to lead to this, or as Isaiah Thomas said, his career would have been over. So think about the implications of his having to degrade himself in this kind of way. Calls to mind the slavery days, or the days of Jim Crow, and when you had to, you know, move off the sidewalk if you were black to let a little, you know, you were a grown black man, you had to move off the sidewalk to let a little white kid walk on the sidewalk. That's what all this was encapsulating and concentrating and calling back to mind and bringing back the reality that this is still with us, even if in some different forms most of the time. Now, what was very significant was that, and lost in all this, which shows the fakeness element again, is that at that time in the NBA, if you were caught fighting, and in particular throwing a punch in a game, you would be expelled from that game and not allowed to play in the next game. Well before this play at the very end with Isaiah Thomas throwing the bad pass and Larry Bird intercepting it and scoring the winning basket, while the Pistons were still ahead earlier in the game, and here are some of the ironies. The center of the Boston Celtics, Robert Parrish, who was black but playing for the white team, got into a fight, a one-sided fight, with Bill Laimbeer, the white center of the Detroit Pistons. Bill Laimbeer, I think his father was an executive, a GM. I think he said, "I think I'm the only guy in the NBA whose father makes more money than I do." But Robert Parrish punched Bill Laimbeer in plain sight with a referee standing right there 3 or 4 times, and nothing was done about it. He was allowed to stay in the game. Now, you have to understand, it's not that they couldn't have rigged the sixth game, but it's harder to make a team lose at home, especially when they're on the verge of winning a whole series. So if Detroit had won this game in Boston and then gone back to Detroit for game 6, they could have made him lose it, but it would have been harder. They might have had to adjust what they were doing. So this incident was hardly incidental with Robert Parrish. He should have been thrown out of the game right then. Had he been thrown out of the game, that could very well have led to a situation where the game wasn't even close at the end, and even if Isaiah Thomas made a mistake, it wouldn't have mattered. You never hear about that anymore. Oh, after the game, they quote-unquote reviewed the films and saw that Robert Parrish punched Bill Laimbeer, so he was not allowed to play in the sixth game. But that didn't matter because the Celtics, this decision was made after the Celtics had already won game 5, so it didn't matter if they lost game 6 because game 7 would be back in Boston. But had they lost game 5 and then Robert Parrish had been thrown out and then not allowed to play in game 6, that would have made it even harder for them to fix the game for the Celtics. But nobody ever talks, you don't see the replay of that very often. And, you know, Bill Laimbeer was involved in another irony as part of this NBA marketing strategy. Finally, the next year in 1988, the Pistons did break through. They finally beat the Celtics. The marketing strategy was changing. Now it was the Detroit Pistons, the bad boys, but very disciplined bad boys who played a slow-down, disciplined style of game with a lot of defense. Understand one thing about the way this is all structured. Defense, discipline. Offense, not so disciplined. So that year, the Pistons won, 1988, finally. Then they got in a series, championship series, playing whom? The Los Angeles Lakers. Lo and behold. And they were ahead in this series, 3-2. And the sixth game was being played in Los Angeles. And they were ahead by 1 point going down to the end of the game. And Magic Johnson took the ball and passed it into Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Now, interestingly, to back up for a second and leave you hanging with the drama here, Magic Johnson, in the beginning of his career, when he came out of Michigan State, to a large degree made his living and his career by passing the ball to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who had this famous shot called the Skyhook that was basically unstoppable. He's like 7'2", and he had perfected the shot that nobody could block or really contend. Magic Johnson passed the ball to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar puts it in. Magic Johnson gets an assist. During one of the first times, one of the first years of Magic Johnson in the league, they were playing the Celtics, and it was apparently the Celtics' time to win. So there was a pivotal game right near the end of the game. The game was tied. Magic Johnson had the ball. Now remember, he's made his career up to this point by doing one basic thing. Well, not one. He did many things, but pivotal to what he was able to do was one basic thing: pass the ball to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So there are about 5 seconds to go. Magic Johnson has the ball. If the Lakers score in this game against the Celtics, they'll win. And Magic Johnson has the ball, and suddenly, he acts as if he's from outer space. What am I supposed to do with this ball? Who's that big, tall guy up there? And he just held on to the ball while the clock kicked down, never passing it to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And the game goes into overtime, and the Lakers lose to the Celtics. Magic Johnson was getting his inauguration into how the things work. Obviously, he'd been told, this is the way it works here. On this particular occasion, you will not pass the ball to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar because he might put it in the basket. But now we jump ahead to 1988. Kareem Abdul's got the ball. He takes a shot. And it doesn't go in. Right at the end of the game. Pistons win, right? Wrong. Have you ever seen that commercial with the little kid playing in his driveway? And he's narrating the game that he's playing. He's like about a 10-year-old kid, but he's narrating. He's playing in some championship game in front of throngs of people. And he says, he dribbles around. He drives in the lane. He pulls up. He shoots. And the ball clanks off the basket and doesn't go in. And then there's a pause, and the little kid says, he was fouled! Well, this is what happened with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He takes the shot. Bill Laimbeer's guarding him. He puts up the skyhook, but this time it doesn't go in. He was fouled! Kareem Abdul-Jabbar goes to the free throw line, hits the winning free throw shots, and the Lakers win and then go on to win the series. So Isaiah Thomas had to wait another year. A phantom foul. This is a thing right down to the incident I described earlier with Dwayne Wade in the series between Miami and Dallas. A phantom foul. What they call a ticky-tack foul, a touch foul, which usually is never called, especially at the end of the game. And you always hear them say, when, you know, the announcers, you know, reading from their script, literal or figurative, when a foul's not called that should have been, you'll hear them say, well, this is the way it should be. The officials shouldn't decide the game at the end. They should let the players decide it. Well, that sounds good until you think about how metaphysical it is. The players are supposed to decide it by playing according to certain rules. Now, if you extend that logic, you know, if somebody's fouled and the official doesn't call it, he's not really letting the players decide it. He's allowing the rules to be violated according to which the players are supposed to decide it. And you could, you know, if you just take an extreme example, you're not allowed to touch or bump people when they have the ball or when they're shooting. Imagine if somebody has a shot right near the basket and you come in and level them as they're about ready to shoot, and the referee doesn't call it because, well, I don't want to decide the game. I want to let the players decide the game. Well, this is clearly absurd, but you'll hear them say this all the time when the announcers know that, oh, well, that's the way it was supposed to go. So then they've got to explain to people who are watching the game, hey, how come that foul wasn't called? Well, we don't want the officials to decide the game. The players should decide it on the court. But it is generally true that they will not call fouls as closely at the end of the game because there are these sort of marginal fouls that really don't have an effect on the play. And they might call them earlier in the game, but when the game is on the line, they rightly don't call them Because it would, you know, you would be sort of imposing a technicality when really the essence of what happened is not according to that technicality. But when it's supposed to go a certain way, then the lightest of touches will be called. And that's either called a touch foul, a ticky-tacky foul, or a phantom foul. And that's what happened to Bill Laimbeer in that incident. Well, then let's move on and talk about the person or the demigod, as he was built up to embody the greatness of the NBA. The greatest of all time, now declared, Michael Jordan. Now, let me just say, first off, it is impossible. People sometimes who know I like basketball and watch it a lot and played it as long as I could will say, well, you know, who do you think are really great players? And it's actually not possible to say who are, you know, you can tell who's really good. Certainly Michael Jordan was. As I said, I even think Larry Bird was. But it's not possible to say, is this player better than that one, even if they play in the same era. In other words, it's hard to compare players who played under whole different, circumstances 30 years ago to players who play now. But even the players who play at the same time, because there's all this other stuff going on. Even in college, but especially on the NBA level. And, you know, all these things are a matter of subtlety. I mean, there is a lot of art as well as science involved in basketball, and there's a lot of nuance. There is a tremendous amount of technique. That may not be apparent, but there's a tremendous amount of technique involved in a sport like basketball. There's footwork involved. If you don't have the right footwork, your body's not balanced in the right way, it's very difficult to make a shot. Usually you don't even notice that because, as with anything, somebody who's really good at something makes it look almost effortless and does it in such a unified way that you don't see all the component parts. When they're first learning it, they have to work on making all the component parts right and getting them all to fit together. But then if you make a leap, as with other forms of matter and motion, and you do this all in a synthesized way. But if you would break it down, you'll see that footwork's tremendously important. Actually, how you shoot the ball, like if your elbow is out like this, you're not going to be able to shoot the ball as well. You can't control it as well. Your wrist has to be somewhat under the ball and go like that to follow through, or you can't control the course of the ball. You have to have the right spin on it. If you see a slow motion picture of a basketball, you'll see it spinning backwards. That's because you put backspin on it by going like that. Ooh. And it causes the ball to spin backward, and it has more chance of going in because very rarely do you get it in. The basket is actually twice the size of the basketball, even though it may not appear to be. So that's a small margin of error if you're shooting from, say, 20 feet away. So if you're not going to get it perfectly in there most of the time. You may touch part of the rim. But if you have this backspin, it causes it to sort of die when it hits the basket, and it has more chance to bounce around and go in. Well, there's all this kind of technique. And then there's a question of if somebody gets in your way at the last second, and contests your shot. Well, when you look at all that and how finely tuned all this has to be, even if it appears to be done, unconsciously, quote unquote, and it is sort of become second nature after you synthesize it. And then you think about the element of confidence. At that second, when you go like that, whether you have confidence that, for example, if you miss your shot, it's very likely that they'll be, he was fouled. You're going to shoot with a lot more confidence. When the game's on the line at the end, when you got to make what they call a clutch shot at crunch time, a game-deciding shot, all this goes into it. Just a little bit of loss of confidence will make all the difference in the world. You won't follow through exactly right. You'll tighten up. If you tighten up on your follow through, when you see these guys shoot the ball in a basketball game and it goes short, it's they tightened up on their follow through. They went like that and they didn't really follow all the way through to get the right trajectory on the ball. Well, if you are doubting in the back of your mind whether even if you get fouled it won't get called, that's going to affect your confidence and your shooting, whether somewhat unconsciously and sometimes consciously. Or there are other little subtle things. For example, some players are very good at dribbling the ball and going by people and going to the basket. But in basketball, they have what they call the offensive foul, where if some defender gets in your way and establishes himself in the path that you're going in, and then you just run over him, that's a foul on you. In other words, you lose the ball, and you get 5 fouls in a game or 6 in the NBA, and you're out. Well, a referee can have a subtle but a profound influence. Let's say you have a player who's very good at that. They do it one or two times, and actually the defender reaches in and bumps them. But the referee, for reasons higher than the team and lower than God, calls the foul on the offensive player. And let's say the offensive player's whole game is geared around being able to, as they call it, drive, dribble the ball to the basket this way. And you get called for that once or twice, and again, you're going to stop doing it. And your whole game is going to be ineffective. So there are all these subtle factors that in other words, it's not a level playing field here. There's no way to determine who's the greatest of all time. It's kind of a metaphysical category anyway. And the important point here, it has everything to do with marketing. And Michael Jordan was not only a key element of NBA marketing after a certain point, but he was in himself a big corporate interest, or bound up with other corporate interests beyond the NBA, Nike shoes in particular. Remember, though, there were those Spike Lee ads with Michael Jordan where he called him money because, you know, the money is like, see, this is a little, the language tells you things. A money shot is when, something's on the line, you make the shot, you're money. So he was calling him money, and, you know, and Spike Lee characters, how are you so great? How do you come through, money? You know, it must be the shoes. You know, and it was in the persona of that character from one of Spike Lee's movies, and you know, Michael Jordan keeps repeating the frame, no, it's not the shoes. Well, it turns out to a significant degree, among other things, it was the shoes. Not in the sense that the shoes made him good, but you step back again and think about it. Nike is one of the biggest corporations in the world. Michael Jordan is the most identified figure associated with Nike for years. Can you just imagine the high-level negotiations that are going on between Nike and David Stern? And do you really think in this kind of context, with literally billions of dollars involved in all this, that they're going to just let it be decided on the court whether Michael Jordan's team wins and whether he does well? So it does turn out to be, at least in part, the shoes after all. Now I remember back in 1991, NBC had just outbid other networks to get the rights to televise the NBA and the NBA Finals in particular. It had been CBS up to that time. And I was rooting for the Portland Trailblazers. Even though I knew, see the way they get you with all this dualism. I knew all this stuff all the time, but I just put it aside. You know, I said, well, goddammit, maybe they'll win anyway, my team, you know. And see how hard it is to rupture with some of this shit? Even when you know it, you still don't want to believe it. So we should not be too impatient with people who in other spheres have a hard time casting off their illusions, even while we should work harder to do so ourselves. And my team was the Portland Trailblazers because I love that Houston team, Phi Slamma Jamma, which I wrote an article about. And Clyde Drexler was my favorite player on that team, a beautiful style of play, and really athletic and graceful and beautiful. And I'd always get frustrated because they'd always lose to the Lakers. Because it was the Lakers and the Celtics. But finally, they'd gone to the championship in 1990, and then they'd lost. So then next year came around, 1991, and they had a great season. They won more games than anybody. They won more games in a row than anybody during the season. They won more games away from home than anybody. They did everything but figure into the marketing strategy. And it came time for the NBA playoffs after the regular season. Just before they started, there was a magazine people used to send me that it went out of business. It was called The National. It was a sports magazine. It came out for a little while. And a guy who used to work for Sports Illustrated named Frank DeFord was one of the big people in this magazine, sports magazine. And I'm reading about the NBA playoffs, and despite myself, I'm getting all excited again. And then I see this article in The National, an interview with Marv Albert, one of the main sports announcers who had to go through a sex scandal before he could come back and be an announcer again. You know, you may have heard him. He has that sort of distinctive style. Yes, and it counts! And he's back announcing games again. And or he'll talk about a player who's been not doing too well and started doing better and say, so-and-so, showing signs. So I'm reading this interview with Marv Albert and my heart almost stopped because they're talking about the NBA Finals and how they might come out. And Marv Albert, who was a big announcer for NBC, not an incidental figure, says, well, I really think it might be the Lakers and the Bulls this year because I think the fans, would really like to see Magic and Michael, Magic Johnson of the Lakers, Michael Jordan for the Bulls, play off in the NBA Finals. And I went, oh, shit. There it is. And lo and behold, who played in the NBA Finals that year? First year for NBC, it's very important, their marketing. It's not that Marv Albert set the marketing, it's he was articulating what was going to happen. And lo and behold, and I don't believe it was coincidence, who played in the Finals? Magic and Michael. The Lakers and the Bulls. It's the first year the Bulls won a championship with Michael Jordan. And I'm sitting here reading this and just shaking my head, you know, and trying even after that to watch these things, knowing what's going to happen. And I watch the series where the way they do is the teams in the Western Conference playoff and then they get a champion, and the teams in the Eastern Conference playoff and they get a champion, then they play. So Portland and Los Angeles Lakers are in the Western Conference and they play in the final of the Western Conference. Portland has the better record. They have more games at home. And in the first game, Portland's ahead. They're doing well. And it comes the fourth quarter, which, by the way, if you don't know the NBA, never mind the first three quarters. What really happens is it's decided in the fourth quarter you can have a 20-point lead or be behind by 20 points. It doesn't matter. And especially the last four minutes, and most especially the last 2 minutes are when you can tell what's really going to happen. All of a sudden, the Portland Trailblazers started getting fouls called on them all over the place. They had a 15-point lead or so, and then they end up losing the game. And they ended up losing the series. And it all worked out. Boy, what a prognosticator that Marv Albert was. And this was the beginning of the Michael Jordan era of winning championships. And they won three of them. Now, to step back for a second, it's interesting that when Jordan was earlier in the league, toward the beginning, he broke his ankle at the beginning of one season. And there was a question of whether he was going to be able to come back or come back fully. They have a break in the season in February when they play the All-Star game, which is the only NBA game that's fake, but everybody knows it. That's the difference. Everybody knows it. And at that time, there was an article, interestingly, in the sports section of the New York Times during this break for the All-Star game about Michael Jordan's broken ankle. And remember, I referred to Julius Erving, who was beginning to go past the prime of his career. And there was a question posed in this article, who is going to take up the mantle? In other words, who is going to be cast in the role of representing that style of play in the NBA? And the article said, well, Michael Jordan's now become a question mark because of his broken ankle. And it mentioned two other people who might fill this role, Dominique Wilkins, who is a tremendously athletic player, and Clyde Drexler. And I've always believed to this day that Michael Jordan must have read that article very carefully because he came back much earlier than he was supposed to that year and reestablished himself in that role as replacing and taking over the Julius Erving style of play. So this was the Michael Jordan era. And then after three seasons, in the third year when the Bulls won a championship with Michael Jordan, there was all this stuff came out about how Michael Jordan is kind of a compulsive gambler. Gambles on everything, golf, anything you can imagine. And run up big gambling debts. And their questions were being raised even during the NBA playoffs about whether this gambling that he was doing was influencing. Here, what an irony. Is this gambling Michael Jordan's doing, is this somehow compromising the integrity of the league? You know, talk about three-card Monty. I mean, the real integrity of the league is completely compromised by the whole way in which they do all the things I've been talking about. But this became a big question because it doesn't look good. Maybe the gamblers would have an influence on Michael Jordan. And Michael Jordan came out with a statement, I'm not Pete Rose. Pete Rose got caught, a big-time baseball player, got caught while he was a manager, I believe, betting on betting on sports, and he insisted he didn't bet on baseball, but everybody believes he did. So, you know, if you're betting on the games you're involved in, obviously that could have an effect on how you play. So this was a big question, and it kind of got shoved to the background, and Jordan won his championship. And then after that, he retired for the first time. And very interestingly, at the press conference when he retired, he said, well, I'm watching this press conference, and he says, I've accomplished everything I could accomplish. And I'm saying, translation, David Stern told you, you ain't getting no more championships now. There's nothing really more for me to accomplish here. And then he said the following, when he was asked, well, would you ever reconsider, would you ever come back? And listen to what he said. He said, if the urge comes back, if the Bulls will have me, if David Stern lets me back in the league, I may come back. That tells you a whole lot right there about everything that I've been speaking to. If David Stern lets me back in the league. And he did. A couple of years later, there was a whole thing going on. You know, there's that Paul Simon line again about, you know, what do I do now that my role model is gone? Well, what was the NBA going to do now that their role model was gone? They had all these younger generation players coming in, you know, were more influenced by the gang stuff. This was posing a problem. They didn't have any positive role models. So Michael Jordan came back, but they already had a plan for that year. Houston and New York were playing, or Houston won a championship. So Jordan got into the playoffs, but he didn't win that year. But then he started winning again the year after. And obviously this was a process of high-level negotiation between Jordan and all the business interests he's bound up with, his own Nike, whatever, and David Stern and all that he represents in terms of the NBA. So they found it in their interest to bring him back, but they couldn't just bring him back. You can't have Michael Jordan at that point. He tried it one more time, and they said, sorry, Michael, we've moved on, and you're too old. But they couldn't just bring him back when he was so close to his prime, and they put so much into marketing, and have him just become another player on another team that didn't go very far. So he won a bunch of more championships. Now let's talk about another angle of this. Speaking of role models, recently the NBA's come out with a dress code. No gang type shit when you're, you know, in the arena, even if you're not playing. You got to wear respectable clothes, you know, sport slacks and a sport jacket, you know, modest business attire. Now, what is all this about? Think back to what I was reading earlier from Mel Watkins about the minstrel shows. You want all this athleticism, this excitement, even a caricature of what basketball is really about. An orchestrated and choreographed farce, in effect. Not that the players don't have great ability, but a farce that they're enacting, in effect, and in the final analysis. Marketed to a certain audience and a certain demographic, and one that has to be non-threatening. So you have to make it safe for the wealthy, white, and corporate audience that you have. Even if you introduce rap and even some outer manifestations of the inner city and gang life and whatever, it has to be made sanitized and safe. So, for example, we had this absurd and degrading spectacle of Kevin Garnett, another player who came out of Chicago and went directly to the NBA, didn't go to college. After one game, he was talking about a teammate, and they said, well, you know, what do you think about what so-and-so did in this play? And he said, yeah, he's my dog, you know. He's your what? So this became a whole scandal. And the next game, they had to interview Kevin Garnett to explain that dog meant friend. It was something positive. That he wasn't introducing some note of discord and antagonism by calling a fellow player my dog. It has to be kept safe for the marketing demographic. Now, let me be clear. There are a lot of white people who'd be perfectly happy if it weren't so fucking safe, but that's not the marketing strategy of the NBA, just to be clear about what's motivating and dictating how this goes. So you had this absurd and degrading spectacle of Kevin Garnett having to explain the use of the word dog to this audience so they'd know it wasn't, oh, it's not a conspiracy, it's okay. They're just talking about Friends. Now, another thing that sheds light on this is how they cleaned up the league with their drug policies. You can't have a bunch of players running around on cocaine, or even the suggestion that they might be doing that. By the way, this is also a good way to get rid of a player. You have a drug policy. Remember, I read a quote about Eitan Thomas in another context. Well, besides killing somebody if they're getting too threatening, you can just go put drugs in their locker and disgrace them and drive them out of the league that way. So that's another useful purpose to having a drug policy. One time you're suspended for so much, another time you're suspended for so much longer, then you're out. And this raises a question recently, or points attention to something. Recently was the 20th anniversary of the death of Len Bias. Len Bias was a great player who came out of the University of Maryland in the mid-1980s. And here's an interesting phenomenon. This was the mid-80s, and they already were thinking ahead to their marketing strategy, and they were beginning to move to change the image of the Celtics. They'd gotten the league going again. I mean, remember, back in the late 70s, you couldn't even... The NBA Finals, you know, were not the big production they were, and even some of the big games in the playoffs were on tape delay. And nothing like the big television bonanza it is now. And having it become that was all driven by this market strategy. So you had to clean up the image. You had to make it safe and non-threatening. And part of that was having a very strict drug policy, and not only literally the policy, but if any player were caught with drugs, especially something like cocaine, then besides whatever penalties would be handed down, they would be disgraced and maybe driven out of the league just by the way the media would go after them and paint them in a bad light. I mean, there are, you know, people who stand out in opposition to this who, you know, somehow, you know, sneak through a little bit or do a few things, like Rasheed Wallace, who played for the Detroit Pistons. When he was playing for Detroit, was driving a car with some other players, and they were pulled over by the cops, and they had some marijuana in the car. But by the time the cops got there, they didn't. And so the cops came up and they took a sniff and they said, "Have you been smoking marijuana? I mean, do you have any marijuana in the car?" And Rasheed Wallace said, "No, we smoked it all up." But this was a kind of an exception, and Rasheed Wallace is always considered a little bit of an outcast in the NBA context. But cocaine's a whole other matter. So then a question comes up. Here Len Bias was drafted by the Boston Celtics. They were shifting, beginning a shift in the image of the Celtics, moving away from this initial remarketing strategy, Lakers and Celtics, lunch bucket, blue-collar, hard-working, sanitized playground. They're moving to a different marketing strategy. So the Celtics drafted, and you have a draft, players come out of college, and the teams pick an order, and you have to go with the team that chooses you, at least for a few years. So the Celtics had the second pick in the NBA draft, and they picked Len Bias. And Len Bias had a very clean, respectable image. But shortly after he was drafted by the Celtics, he got together with some friends of his and celebrated. And apparently they were doing a lot of cocaine. And Len Bias had his heart stopped. And by the time they got him to the hospital, it was too late and he died. And now it's the 20th anniversary of this, so there have been articles about it. And the question arises, what really killed Len Bias? Now, on the one hand, it appears that cocaine was the immediate cause. Basically, a crisis, you know, of his heart brought on by cocaine, a stoppage of his heart. But in a deeper sense, there's something else going on. Because it turns out that they did not immediately, his friends who were with him, did not immediately rush him to the hospital when he went into effectively a coma. Why not? Because if they took him to the hospital, they'd have to say, what, in order to save him, they'd have to say what happened. And that would have ruined his career in the NBA before it got started. And so they waited, hoping they could revive him. And when finally they felt they couldn't, they rushed him to hospital, but it was too late. So what really killed Len Bias? It wasn't just the cocaine. And let me broaden this out a little bit. You see, there was this player that played in the NBA in the late 70s out of Providence College named Marvin Barnes. And his nickname kind of gives a hint of how what the NBA thought the problem with him was. His nickname was, he was Marvin Bad News Barnes. Now, mainly that was applied to the effect he had on the people who played against him. To play against Marvin Barnes was bad news. But it also came to apply to his broader character. And Marvin Barnes was notorious for showing up in the locker room a few minutes before the game, completely fucked up on cocaine, and going out and scoring 30 points. So it wasn't that his performance was adversely affected. It's that it wasn't the right image. So they said, we got to get rid of this Marvin Bad News Barnes shit and bring in safe, non-threatening, responsible people, since we have to have so many black people to market this. And this came up explicitly around the dress code thing. The head of the players' union and Charles Barkley, I'll talk about this a little bit more later, openly discussed how, look, we have to go along with this dress code because we're in a very touchy situation here. We're a black league playing for a white wealthy audience, so we can't do anything that's going to upset all that. In other words, this is an explicit conscious recognition of what the whole deal is. And Len Bias getting fucked up on cocaine at that point did not fit into this. That would have been the end of his career. Or it would have very seriously impaired his career. So he died. Because his friends didn't take him to the hospital when they should have, because they were trying to think about how to save his career, knowing it was on the line. Now here it's worth it to step back a second and talk about the relationship between where the game's played by the people who love it and organized basketball. In other words, the city playgrounds on the one hand, and then basketball in a more organized form, all the way from high school and college to the NBA. And we should understand that the NBA's way of approaching all this casts its shadow all the way down to the playground these days. Because while a lot of people play just for fun, the ones who really develop the ability and have the skills and yes, the physical attributes. I mean, it was very interesting, by the way, speaking of physical attributes. I was listening to Bill Walton, you know, who is one of the few white players, you know, who played basketball prominently in the last couple of decades and who was very, very good. And he was also a progressive guy, and certainly during the time he was in college, opposed to the Vietnam War, opposed to racism, and openly speaking out on these things. Got arrested in a sit-in and so on. Drove his college coach, John Wooden, the legendary John Wooden, crazy. And I was listening to Bill Walton talk about the ability of the players, and he said something, and when he said it, it jumped out at me at how out of place it is these days. He said, well, let's face it. You know, they're talking about the various abilities of different players. He said, let's face it. All these guys are winners in the genetic lottery. And I was thinking, God, how unusual, if you pardon the expression, how unusual it is to hear somebody talk in that way instead of saying, well, they all have God-given ability. You know, Bill Walton has this distinctive way of speaking. You know, oh, come on now. That's no foul. So he's saying, they're all winners in the genetic lottery. But this is very unusual to hear somebody talking this way instead of God-given ability. But they all, these people who make it to the, even the college, let alone the NBA, are all quote-unquote winners in the genetic lottery. You have to have a certain height for the most part, and you have to have certain physical abilities, which are not God-given and are not attributes of one race or another. There are plenty of white volleyball players that have tremendous leaping ability. They just don't play basketball for the most part. It's not genetic, and there, you know, it does, there isn't any racial correspondence with this. That's a whole other subject we can't get into now, but that's scientifically establishable and established. But there are, you know, I was later going to, in another talk, give an example of what's wrong with certain syllogisms, but here, let me give you an example. All black people are good at basketball. James is black, therefore James is good at basketball. Well, it's logically consistent, but wrong, because the original premise is not true. All black people are not good at basketball. All black people, most black people, are not, quote-unquote, winners in the genetic lottery to play basketball. Nor are all white people losers in that genetic lottery. There's a lot of social factors. But there are genetic factors, not according to race, but across all these race or nationality lines, to whether you can be a good basketball player. Then you develop skills, but you have to have a certain foundation. So, you know, that's part of what goes into it. But many people play on the playgrounds who are never going to be, who aren't winners in the genetic lottery beyond a certain point, not good enough to get into the NBA. But then for those who do start showing that ability and do are winners in the genetic lottery, from very early age, you know, you're living in the ghetto, you want to get the fuck out of there. Spontaneously, this is going to be a big motivation for you. And if you've got basketball ability, that's one way you might get out. So especially these days, this reaches right down and influences even the way people play on the playground. Nonetheless, the game as it's played on the playground is far different than the game in the NBA. And it really is, if you want to look at it that way, the game as it's played on the playground is the economic base, or the material base out of which the game is developed in a more organized way. And they let it be like a lot of laissez-faire, you know, they let people compete and then they, you know, but then there's also connections and whether you're marketable and whether you can articulate things well and speak in a certain kind of language and tone, you know, and they send them to finishing school if they show athletic ability so they can speak in a way that's non-threatening and familiar, comfortable language for the main audience to whom they're marketing this. But there, as I pointed out in the article, the city game and the city no game, which is in the book Reflections, Sketches, and Provocations, there's a unity between the way the game is played on the playground and the way it's played in a more organized, structured way up to the NBA. But it's a unity of opposites. They are not identical. And a lot of things go on the playground in terms of innovation of the game, which then later get adopted and co-opted as you go up the organized ladder of basketball. Innovations on the playground lead to changes in the more organized and structured game and even the coaching of the game. Let me give you an example. There's a way in which, in a certain sense, a whole additional dimension was added to the game of basketball through the combination of dunking the ball, slamming it down through the rim, which means you have to be able to jump high enough to do that and be able to time it, and what's called an alley-oop pass. Someone will take the ball and throw it above the rim or just to the side of the rim up high, and a player who has good jumping ability will come grab the ball and slam it down in. Now, in basketball, is what's called a fast break. That is, instead of the team sort of moving the ball up slowly and then setting up a play near their basket in order to try to score at their basket, they'll get the ball under the other team's basket and go as fast as they can down the court to try to score before the other team gets down and can set up its defense. That's called a fast break. Now, when you're doing a fast break, you try to get an advantage where you have more players running down on your side than there are defenders back trying to stop you, and then you pass to whomever, whichever player the defenders being outnumbered are not able to cover, to get in the way of. And the game used to be limited in dimension in this way. If there was somebody right in the way between you and a player on your team, you couldn't pass the ball to that player because you'd have to throw it through the defender and they would intercept the pass. So you'd have to throw it to someone else. And there are certain times when you bounce the ball on the floor, passing it so it gets by a defender before they can reach down and get it. Another time when you just throw it straight. I won't go into all the technical aspects of that. But those were your choices for a long time. Then, when on the playgrounds, the whole dunk and the alley-oop became something that was developed there, that added a whole different dimension, a whole new productive force, if you will. Because now, if a defender were in the way between you and another one of your players, you could throw it over their head to your own teammate, who then could leap up and grab it and jam it down through the rim. So this was adding an additional, if you will, third dimension to the game. It's not that the dimension wasn't there, but it wasn't being made use of in the same way. And then, so this is an innovation in the game. Even coaches, when this kind of style of play first started being used, if you saw that movie Glory Road or whatever it was, about the Texas Western, now UTEP team, the first team that was in college basketball that started all black players and won a championship against the bastion of segregation and white supremacy, the University of Kentucky at the time, they show how the coach there would not only discourage but really go after his players, these black players he'd recruited, when they dunked the ball, and then he finally had to relent. But this was considered undisciplined play. This is what you do on a playground. Don't bring that playground shit in here. That's what most coaches would say. But after a while, this became so effective that the coaches and the organized structures of the game up to the NBA co-opted it. So now you see this being employed all the time on all levels. But it didn't come from a coach studying a coaching manual. It came from the base down, with the masses of people innovating in the game. And then when it gets up to the college and the NBA level, it gets co-opted and it gets marketed. Now, just to be clear, and if you think of the analogies, perhaps this should be obvious, I do not have, and we should not have, an anti-coaching line. I believe in vanguards. A good coach is needed. It has to do with a discussion, believe it or not, about positivism and so on. Because direct experience in the course of doing something is not sufficient to develop an overall strategy and approach to a game. You don't need a coach in the bourgeois style, let alone the Bobby Knight style, of dictating like a military dictator. But there is a role for abstraction in sports. That's what it has to do with positivism. There is a role for beyond immediate experience. There is a role for someone stepping back before the game and during the game and looking at the larger picture and correctly applying methods. You should be able to draw on the knowledge and wisdom of the players to themselves not only provide raw material for synthesizing a better understanding of how to play the game, but to be involved in the synthesis. But then when they are out playing, they cannot be at the same time stepping back looking at the overall pattern. It's not that they don't understand. Bobby Knight's completely wrong. The players understand a great deal about the game. But in the midst of it, you know, this is where the positivism comes in. You can't get the necessary abstractions. You may be able to get some, but you can't get all the necessary abstractions to know what the other side is doing in the game and how to change your tactics or even your whole strategic approach to the game. You may not even be able to see errors in your technique that are showing up. You may not even recognize when you've become overtaken by fatigue and you need to rest for a little while because you're in the midst of it, and it's necessary for people who are abstracted from that to play a role. So there is a role for this kind of abstraction, for this kind of leadership of the correct kind, not the bourgeois dictatorial kind. But in the NBA, and nowadays even more down to the college and high school levels, the authorities and the operation, the way in which they conduct things, is dictated by something else than enabling the players individually and collectively to do the best they can. It's dictated by the marketing and the selling of two things. First of all, the product as determined by those who own and run this. And second of all, an ideology. A set of values, a way of looking at the world that they are selling and promoting along with the product. And this is all within the framework and ultimately serves the social relations, the underlying production relations, the ideology, the values, the framework, and the dynamics of the capitalist imperialist system. And so it produces a very different synthesis than we could and would produce even in the sphere of basketball. So I want to stop here now, and then we'll have the last section of this talk.